You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM, the home of radio art in the UK, rupturing the airwaves across London and over the web from resonancefm.com.
Let a bothered big sea show you what to do, and this is what he'll tell you. If you got a problem, to know who you are, here now, this is what you do. Remember, you are me, I am you, all of us together.
Receive with simplicity all that happens to you, and welcome to the Naked Short Club on Resonance FM, London's radio art station. I am Dr. Stu, your host, coming to you live for far from Mosul, the Donbass, and London Fashion Week. We're outside Bernie's Schmokehouse in Amsterdam, sat on the stoop, above the gobbles, beneath the gables, beside the Madhofsgracht, shimmering with sad blue, body booth lights. Back inside, they're trading short and blow up, and pouring us another round of the sublime products of our corporate sponsors, made of premium Ponzi beer. 150 years to brew and brood. With us, expert guests, industry mavens, here from their offshore tax havens, to talk dirty about hedge funds, markets, the economy, and wider world. Each is rich and therefore morally sound. Ian Prideaux, CIO at Grosvenor Estate, Britain's largest non-royal family office, former IBM scholar. Richard Edwards, who is actually a former IBM Watson scholar, CEO at CTA, Head Capital. And Simon Fox, director at Institutional Consultants, Mercer. Gabriella Griffith, diary editor at City AM. None the type of Frenchman to walk around without his teeth in. Plus, for poetry, Kate Brain. At the controls, master engineer Mr. Chris Dixon, the only one except for Dr. Stew, who can handle the Madoff Ponzi beer. Strong stuff, so guests, go easy. But now, raise your glasses and tell me, how are you dressed?
We're naked, Dr. Stew.
All sounding drugged up already, but at least you have your own teeth. Now, as ever, there is no fixed agenda, so while we work out what to talk about and whether CalPERS divestment from hedge funds is the end of the world, Mr. Chris Dixon, let's have some music.
Yeah.
Welcome back to the Naked Short Club on Resonance FM. That was the Pretty Things from a simpler duodecimal age when they used to do songs like Pounds, Shillings and Pence. Speaking of which, that was a big issue recently, but we're now stuck with about 50,000 wildlings from north of the wall who run the UK and about 5.2 million without any teeth at all. Anyway, let's get trading. So, Richard Edwards, what's been happening or is happening that's interesting?
Hi, Dr. Stu. Well, it's good of you to remind us about all those welfare-dependent kilt wearers north of the wall. And our press and politicians seem to have had quite a fit of the vapours about the idea that they wanted to carve off and go and establish their own Cuba with added haggis. But it's nice that we can now get back to more important things, such as what's going on in the Middle East, because the price of oil has been shaky, if not weak, lately. And you would have thought that with all the shenanigans going on, not just in the Ukraine, where a lot of gas pipelines cross it, but also in the heart of the Middle East, where a lot of the oil, of course, comes from, you would have thought that oil prices would be higher. But in fact, they've been trembling on what looks to me like a brink. And so you have to ask yourself, with Libyan oil production still cranked up, with Saudis having to cut back on production, which is something they don't usually publicly announce, they just get on and do it, but with increased oil energy production from the United States, both gas and tight oil, possible resumption of nuclear power generation in Germany, or at least they won't maybe phase it out as quickly as they were going to, and maybe even some fracking finally happening in Europe, are we going to be faced with an oversupply of petrol, gasoline, so on and so forth? And if so, what are the likely effects on Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar? And what's the likely knock-on effect on the funding for terrorism? So this is all, I think, a great deal more interesting than what happens to a load of tartan terrorists. So that's what's happening in my world.
Okay, thanks for that. Let's go over to Ian Prideaux now. Make us some money, Ian.
I'd love to. I'm worried about, concerned, shall we say, about why volatility is so low. At the moment, the VIX index is trading somewhere around 12, almost as low as it's ever been. I think its lowest was 10 point something back in July. But when you ally that with relatively high level of equities, bond yields, which have gone into reverse again this year, and 10-year yields back down at relatively low levels, interest rates still low, then what's this telling us about the world economy? It seems to be indicating slow but stable growth, low interest rates, no inflation, no deflation, and no geopolitical risks. Do we really believe that?
I sure don't know. We will find out what the others think later. But in the meantime, Simon, what's up in your world?
There are two things on my mind at the moment, Dr. Stu. The first is maybe a bit of a soapbox comment about ESG factors, environmental, social and governance factors, and how hedge funds take them into account, or more accurately, how they often don't take them into account. The theory behind ESG integration has got widespread acceptance within the Lioni space, both in terms of the way it can impact buy and sell decisions, but also more generally about activism and shareholder approach to shareholder activism. Whilst we often sort of think about hedge fund governance as the sort of be-all and end-all to responsible investing in hedge funds, I think it's important to think for managers like long-short equity funds that there are ways of integrating ESG factors into their decision-making process that would be greeted very favourably by a lot of investors, because they have strong belief in the efficiency of those factors to add value, but also because they satisfy a broader approach towards ESG investing. If I've got time, I had one other thing that was a bit more diffuse, but I thought I'd throw into the conversation, and that was a more general question about how hedge funds can and should be used in broader portfolio construction. There's been a lot of change over the last few years in terms of how people think about portfolios. The original mean variance optimization has made way for factor investing, risk parity, lots of different ways of thinking about portfolios. What does that mean for hedge funds and how people should look at them? Are they an asset class? Were they ever an asset class? Should we be thinking about EM hedge funds in the EM portfolio? Or do we have to still treat them as pure alpha generators? What's the implication for hedge funds themselves, particularly as they're looking to raise money in a pretty difficult market environment?
Good one, because that's something that divides opinion fairly markedly. We'll come back to that in a little bit. Now, let's ask the same of Gabriella Griffith. First, though, listeners will be delighted, overjoyed, that lines are now open to the Emergency Hedge Fund Helpline on 1-800-DISTRESSED. So whether you're a CTA bucked by lack of trend, an Argentinian bondholder, or a Coco's Mark II mania sufferer, do not be shy. Bernie and the Switchboard team await your calls. While I'm Dr. Stu, and I'm listening. Now, Gabriella, let's break the bank. So, to you, what's interesting?
Well, Stu, I think we need to talk about CalPERS. It's the California's $300 billion pension giant. It said it's pulling out of hedge funds due to a lack of transparency and high fees. Well, they were trailblazers when it came to investing in pension funds originally, in hedge funds. So what does it mean for the rest of the industry, and what does it mean for the UK? And also, are pension funds good for hedge funds in the first place? Do hedge funds really want to be on the public sector payroll? Secondly, Stu, I think we should talk about inversions. All eyes are on Obama this week. Will he take action to curb them? Obviously, there's been a flurry of inversion activity at the moment. Burger King and Tim Hortons taking a lot of the attention. Does it spell trouble for merger arbitrage strategies?
Very interesting. Thank you for that. Look, Simon and Ian, stop biting Richard. Have some of these yum, crunch, tasty naked nut company nuts instead. Now, Kate Brain, the cobbles here outside Bernie's smokehouse are yours.
Grandpa, I'm sure I saw you this morning yelling and shaking your fist whilst rolling down the window at breakneck speed with your parrot on your shoulder squawking Bolsheviks. And then later I heard you complain to a supermarket worker who you certainly thought too young to be able to satisfy your question about why the bloody hell they must keep moving the bread to a different aisle. Then at the post office, your grumblings at the price of a first-class stamp. And why on earth was everyone asking for oysters? On the bus, though, I saw you insisting to a very pregnant lady she take your seat and saw how you opened your legs as though on the bridge of a battleship in stormy weather. How you refused help off the bus with, "Very kind, but I'm absolutely capable of descending off this omnibus myself, young man." I then followed you past a bored, tied-up dog and smiled as you slipped him a good boy chocky drop. The dog's wag your reward and mine your chuckle. I followed you through the park where you had a plastic bag with fresh bread for the ducks in one pocket and in the other a bag to collect stabbed rubbish with your sharpened fire poker. And down the pub, when you were asked what you wanted in your whiskey, you replied, "The only thing to put into whiskey is more whiskey." On Remembrance Day, you always got your grandchildren to throw poppy seeds in the back garden. But you never spoke much of the two wars you fought in, your medals hidden in a deep place. And at the end, you're flirting with all the nurses, slipping them chocolate liqueurs on duty and asking them to come closer so you could read the time on their watch fob brooch. I see you still everywhere, Grandpa, and we will always sow more poppy seeds and remember.
Now, Kate, that was just excellent, so thanks. Now, guests, let's take a pause and reflect. Not bad, is it, here in Amsterdam? We can smoke some blow. We can do a show, sink some of that delicious made of Ponzi beer. And here comes another round. Thanks, Fabrice. Just put the tray down there. Good they let you out. And now each of you pop one of these, Dr. Stu's little blue alpha pills. Here, take one. Little pick my lousy returns up to protect you 2 and 20. Just wash it down with Ponzi. Yeah, good. Now, lots more to talk about. So while we do gather our thoughts, Mr. Chris Dixon, let's have some more music.
I be your mirror, reflect what you are. In case you don't know, I be the wind light on your door to show that you're home. When you think the night has in your mind that inside you're twisted and unkind, let me stand to show that you are blind. Please put down your hands, 'cause I see. Darkness, so you won't be afraid. When you think the night has in your mind that inside you're twisted and unkind, let me stand to show that you are blind. Please put down your hands, 'cause I see you.
Welcome back to the Naked Short Club, live from Amsterdam on Resonance FM, London's radio art station. That was the Velvet Underground, and I am Dr. Stu, your host, Master Engineer Chris Dixon at the controls. Now, what were people talking about earlier? Didn't make much sense to me, but Gabriella was talking about CalPERS divestment from hedge funds and asking whether... Not only the question, are hedge funds good for pension funds, but are pension funds good for hedge funds? Ian was talking about how it's potentially actually disturbing that the VIX is as smooth as a mirror and low. The question is, will it all blow? Richard was talking about oil, which is probably not a million miles away from that particular topic. Simon's talking about ESG and also slightly closer to home. How can hedge funds be used in portfolio construction? No particular agenda worked out for this section either. Let's start with you, Richard.
Hello again, Stu. On the subject of hedge funds and the investment, the institutional investment sector, I think we may have gone down a wrong road here. The genesis of the business, let's say, 25 years ago, I mean, we all know it started in 1948, but the real genesis of this business in the late 80s, early 90s, was of traders with talent taking profits out of markets. And nobody had a target rate of return. They just made as much money as they could. And some turned out to be good and some turned out to be not. And the limiting factor was always how much money they could handle. And so if a good trader made profits, they would get more money under management. Maybe they would continue to make good profits, and maybe they would not. But eventually, almost all of them got promoted to their level of incompetence, the old Peter principle. And so returns fell away. And that has become institutionalized, I think, not in the sense that institutions have come into the business so much, but returns are now generally much lower than they were. And I think that this is in main part the reason. So some of the hedge funds, which arguably are not really hedge funds, but maybe giant CTAs, futures trading organizations, are handling unthinkably large amounts of money. It used to be considered, back in those Genesis days, that the maximum amount that a trader could handle without going mad was $200 to $300 million. And now that's where you begin to start. That's just your entry level. That's your entry level CTA or hedge fund. And so I think rather than the hedge fund, instead of the hedge fund business corrupting the institutional investment world, it's kind of happened the other way around. The institutions in their reach for yield, because, of course, we've had a declining yield environment in this 25 years as well, this reach for yield has spoiled the fun of being in the hedge fund business. And you've got to have corporate relations people now. It's just terrible.
Thanks, Richard. Your comments are well made. Of course, $200 to $300 million isn't worth what it used to be. But I take your point. That's the entry ticket these days. I'm just looking at hedge fund performance this year and thinking how insipid it is. HFRI, Fund of Fund Diversified, up 2.5%, 8 months to the end of August. Not exactly setting the world alight, is it? And let's just remember that's 2.5%, having taken off the 2 and the 20. And all very well taking off the 2%, it's not a bad level of management fee. If you're running sort of a few billion dollars, 2% adds up to quite a lot. But why take off the 20 if you haven't even achieved a gross level of return equal to, say, LIBOR plus 4 or something like that? I would like to see the general acceptance of a hurdle rate. So take your 2% by all means. But if you haven't, after that, made me LIBOR plus 4, don't get your incentive fee as well. This is some.
Would you pay more than 20% on anything over the hurdle rate?
If it was far enough over the hurdle rate, I suppose the answer is yes. But as a principle, why is the hedge fund industry not sort of behaving in the same way that the private equity industry does, where generally speaking, the manager only gets, or the GP only gets, his incentive fee once the LP has got an 8%. Preferred return. So I think this year to date's results are particularly sort of germane here. You know, 2.5%, that's a net return, the manager having had a 20% incentive fee, presumably off of a 2% management fee and a 20% incentive fee, probably off a gross return of about 5%, I would think.
Ian made a point earlier about VIX being at low levels today, and talked about the general environment. I think it's quite an interesting situation that we find ourselves in, where a few years ago we were seemingly getting to opportunity after opportunity that investors could roll into, and that gave them an opportunity to find yield and to continue to have growth in the portfolios. And we have fewer and fewer opportunities today. I think there are probably still some in the sort of mid-distance horizon that you can capture and that can be quite attractive. But there are less obvious opportunities where we are today. And I think this is the perfect environment to encourage people to be going into hedge funds. But I think Ian has highlighted the real challenge that we have, that when you want to be going into hedge funds and encouraging investors to allocate to hedge funds, performance has been pretty insipid for a number of years now. It's hard to entice people to go into the space. And it's not helped when you have governance issues and fee issues challenging investors as well. I think it all makes it harder just at the time when, from an investor perspective, this is a good opportunity to be thinking about allocating to hedge funds and balancing out the portfolio.
But Dr. Stu sees various things written about this. Here's people talking about it. But Simon, if you had someone taking a critical view of all of this, do you want to go down another level? Tell us, you know, what is the case for investing in hedge funds right now?
Well, so I think there's a strategic case that's always existed about a different source of returns. There are many periods that we go through in investing where the equity market just doesn't deliver you anything. Long periods of time. And if you have to earn growth to pay your pensioners to be able to fund your endowment, you need to make sure you have a diversified mix of return drivers within the portfolio. Hedge funds can do that. They try and capture a set of returns from a different area of the investment markets. And you can argue that today you're seeing a sort of return to lower intra-stock correlations. You've seen the banks step back and an opportunity for hedge funds to provide liquidity where others are moving away. M&A activity, given the comment about inversions, I won't say much on, but you know, there are clearly opportunities around capital structure and all those sorts of things that should be good for hedge funds. But that could be an opportunistic argument for it. But I think the stronger one is a strategic one, that as you're investing, you want to have a breadth and diversification of different return drivers within your portfolios. Hedge funds are by no means a panacea for investing, but they do make a good component of an investment portfolio.
Okay, you know, this is particularly close to Dr. Stu's heart at the moment, since he's wrestling with how to address a particular topic at the Quant Invest conference in London on the 30th of the month. as part of a panel with Nathan Peters from, Paul Seaton from Fulcrum and Matt Roberts from Terrence Watson, just looking at viable alternatives, should they exist, to current CTA offerings. You know, does this just take us down the low-cost ETF route? Does it take us down the route of just not bothering? Does it take us into the realms of just beyond passive risk parity? And, you know, particularly with CalPERS disinvestment and that, for example, of the Dutch Metalworkers Fund, news of which came through today, you know, I think the case for investing in hedge funds isn't as obvious as it used to be, and yet more and more money is coming in, including from institutional sources. Anyway, over to you, Richard. Carry on whichever way you want.
Let's not forget why markets do what they do, which is that people get very complacent after a long rise, and they get very comfortable with being long. And only when markets have fallen a lot and for a prolonged period of time do people become bearish. That is, they are basically the wrong way at every turn. And so now, even though returns have been poor in hedge funds, and it's inarguable that they have been, there are some reasons for that. Volatility is low. The VIX itself is low. But let's not forget one of the main reasons for the existence of hedge funds is to play defensively. And so when you get a horrible, sickening lurch in markets, which can happen at any time without any fundamental reason, a 20% drop or even worse, then the job of hedge funds is not to lose. Hopefully to make, but not to lose. And so that's when they become a genuinely alternative asset class, I think. And perhaps that's the only time when that is true, because otherwise I don't think they are an asset class. I think it's just a skill set, to echo your point, Simon. And that's my thinking on that. On the subject which is most dear to my heart, however, which is oil, we know that the Saudi Arabian government is flush with cash. That's because they say so. But 10 years ago, or perhaps a little bit more, when the oil prices were low, to everybody's shock and surprise, Saudi Arabia became a borrower privately within the Gulf. They borrowed from the United Arab Emirates, and it was an open secret at the time, although it was a state secret. You know, you could be arrested for knowing this, or at least for talking about it. And that was at a time when Saudi Arabia absorbed a great deal less of its oil revenues than it does now. It didn't have the overheads that it assumed in the intervening years. And so everybody assumes that that country is terribly rich because it's got vast oil reserves and it pumps a lot. And oil prices have been very high for some time. However, I think Saudi Arabia has considerable expenses, and it's because it's a political player in the Middle East, it's those expenses have gone up and up and up, because their way of participating is to pay. They don't send soldiers, they don't bomb people from the air, they pay. They pay allies in different countries, and that's very expensive. So if oil prices crack, let's say they slip from here to $80, it's not inconceivable, it's only a 15% fall, something like that, then would Saudi Arabia stop pumping to support the price, or would they have to chase it down and pump more, which would then cause the price to crack more and more and maybe go down to $30 again? At which point, you'd then have to worry how Saudi Arabia would pay its bills. It might actually have to issue a bond. But it might also stem some of the money which is coming out, not from the governments in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, and the UAE, but from private individuals to fund what we consider to be undesirable groups. So nobody's accusing the governments of these countries of funding terrorists, but we know that a lot of their private citizens do, and that's possibly because of the indiscriminate way in which money is sprayed around inside these economies. So if you are devout and a friend of the ruler, you're in line to get rich. And what you do with your money is then your business.
I just had a point going back to the Middle East. I know ISIS may not be sending the oil price shooting up at the moment, but they are having an effect on one of our private equity cousins here in the city. I thought we should spare a moment for the fate of ISIS Equity Partners, who this afternoon announced that they would have to change their name because they no longer wanted to share it with a terrorist organisation. Where does it stop? There's a lot of ISIS companies out there. Do we all need to change their names?
Silence, everyone. Richard, what's up?
Caliphate's a nice name.
Anyway, Ian, I know you want to say something.
Yeah, what are they going to rebrand as? ISIL? Just IS, maybe. I think they need a strong brand identity. Well-made points, I thought, Richard, about hedge fund performance. This year in particular, insipid performance, we've all said. My biggest concern, I think, is the high level of correlation that we're seeing between hedge fund performance and general equity market performance. And if we take hedge funds back to their roots, the traditional hedge fund enjoyed sort of 2/3 of the upside but only exposed you to 1/3 of the downside. And I think we're seeing much more correlation than that with equity markets generally. And it's sort of intra hedge funds.
Are you suggesting that some, in a sense, there's been an inversion?
Different sort of inversion. I think we're seeing, you know, a lot more beta and a lot less alpha, and I'm not sure it's very smart beta either. A term I've always hated. The best description I've heard of smart beta is smart beta equals dumb beta plus smart marketing. Off my little hobby horse now.
Okay, Simon.
So we've had, interestingly, two different definitions of what a hedge fund is already, those that provide defence and those that provide some upside but limit a bit on the downside. And I think this sort of comes back to then the question of how do you build them into portfolios? And I don't think it's just an abstract top-down question either, because we're also seeing challenge come in from non-hedge fund or traditionally non-hedge fund providers, the traditional houses creating more products that offer this blend of return drivers that offer a bit of upside for a bit less downside, and challenging really the underlying thesis of what a hedge fund is. Is it a real shoot from the hip, earn you big return type manager that probably doesn't suit the big pension schemes, or is it something that's much more stable, much more diversifying, which probably does suit the pension scheme investors, and is probably a good place for them to allocate to?
Yeah, interesting what you say about the correct terminology for a hedge fund. Is it an asset class? I think it's a remuneration system. It's a remuneration system I'm happy to contribute to as long as the underlying returns are there, and happy to pay somebody for really good performance, but not just for average performance.
The new products that you mentioned, Simon, that institutions are introducing, that's reminiscent to me of an earlier time in the derivatives market where fancy over-the-counter derivatives were created in investment banks and then sold to people. Sometimes they needed them, sometimes they didn't. But the big question then to ask of the derivative salesman was, how's this made? How is this actually constructed? What is it you're selling me? What are the mechanics underneath it? And actually, for an institution, let's say a sell-side institution in the current parlance, to create a synthetic hedge fund lookalike or ETF, you'd have to ask, how do they actually make it? What's going in there? What's the engine for the alpha that is supposed to be the important part of a hedge fund? It can't just be a series of puts and some out-of-the-money calls. It wouldn't work that way. So if these things are to perform, I would really like to know the answer to that question.
Well, just to be clear, I wasn't just narrowing it down to sort of alternative premium strategies that are being marketed and brought to market at the moment. I was thinking more generally that certainly on the fixed income side, you see a lot of what you would regard as traditional asset managers that have moved into the absolute return space, lower vol products, but giving you absolute returns that are, have validity. You're even seeing some sort of lower risk equity products as well that can sort of span the hybrid between traditional and hedge fund investing. Even multi-asset strategies, the old DGFs of this world, do a bit of both as well and have some hedge fund type drivers in there for relative value trades, currency positions overlaid with beta. So there's a whole mix of hybrid opportunities out there, some which are bad, some which are potentially quite interesting. I wouldn't say that they're all the right thing for investors to go into. I think the risk premium space is an interesting observation. I think it's a very powerful tool in a portfolio construction perspective if you can get it to work. I think the challenge is all of these premium that you're trying to harvest are effectively trading strategies. And if you're going to try and get the most out of a trading strategy, in many ways, I would want someone that's been doing it for a long time and can demonstrate it, that's got the resources and the implementation to be able to access it and capture it effectively and to really make the most of it. I think trend is a great beta in a portfolio. absolutely, I would always do it through an established managed futures manager at this point in time. Even those that purport to be sort of naive implementers of trend, actually, that the best ones are doing something that's really quite sophisticated and clever and have good implementation behind it. It's brought down fees talking about it as a beta, but I don't think you then automatically go to the cheapest possible option or the simplest possible option as the best way of implementing it, because there are a lot of nuances underneath it that you want specialist managers to be able to try and capture for you.
So you're saying that it still comes down to skill?
I think some of these strategies still have skill in them. It depends where you define skill. It's not necessarily that they have alpha ideas, so they go long for longer or they go short for shorter. The skill or value add in the implementation, the risk management, and the broader process above and beyond just those sort of buy and sell decisions.
Okay, that clarifies that for me. I have another observation, though, about the size of hedge funds and how some of the larger ones run their affairs from my partial knowledge of what's going on. In order to get to the size that some of the larger hedge funds now are, they have basically become, it seems to me, trader farms. Not all of them. Some pursue a single strategy or a few strategies. But a large number of them now are basically full of cubicle fauna, all doing little bits of trading with different capital allocations to them. And that becomes then like a microcosm of the marketplace as a whole. So the traders who do well are given more money. The traders who do not do well get given less money and eventually are kicked out. And so the whole thing is a process of averaging towards some mean, which is not going to be very high. And so now a successful hedge fund ends up with trend performance 8%, 10%, something like that. If that's done consistently, that's regarded as wonderful. And I think that this possibly is the reason why. And so it comes down to it's a similar argument, which is that the skill which is necessary to make substantial profits in markets becomes too diffuse when you spread it over to such a large population of traders, 200 traders in a single firm, for example.
Good point. If somebody made me 8 or 10% consistently in a 1.5% inflation environment, I'd take that every day of the week. But the fact of the matter is you don't get it consistently. And I think this whole discussion is getting us back to the question of sort of what is alpha. And let's just remember that alpha can be negative as well as positive. And I think it's a point well made. You have more and more participants in the market, more and more participants in an individual firm, and you're bound to get an averaging effect. That's more or less inescapable from the maths of the thing. And I don't know what we have now in the market, something like 9,000 investable hedge funds. Our analysis shows that if you really want to make some decent returns, you've got to be in about the best 300 out of that 9,000. And I particularly take your point, Richard, that long-only managers who decide they're now going to be hedge fund managers, I'm pretty sceptical of. To my mind, that means we'd rather earn 2% plus 20 than just a flat 75 basis points. Let's call ourselves a hedge fund and rake in the fees. They've got to justify it.
Because after all, in the long term, we're all dead. So why not get the fees while you can? All right. Okay, there's a lesson in there, I think, for us all. The problem, I suppose, is that this must inevitably lead to huge disillusionment over a period of time. And so if a significant investor in hedge funds, like CalPERS or like your firm, starts to feel
not quite as significant as CalPERS.
Well, you're a lot more significant than they were now than they were than last week, being that they've pulled out. If there's general disillusionment in the level of performance which is available, and if you've got to be in the top 300 hedge funds out of a universe of 9,000, something like that, and will it be the same 300 next year as this year, and let alone the year after, then makes you wonder what's the point, really, because there's an awful lot of hedge fund managers who are making a very good living out of it, but what about the investors? Where are the investors' yachts?
So I think there's part of this comes back to what are you using the hedge funds for? And in some ways, if you're thinking about a portfolio of hedge funds, you're never going to have them beating the equity markets one year, beating the bond markets the next year. They're always going to come somewhere in the middle. They're sort of average, steady, consistent sort of return. And I share a lot of sympathy with Ian that if you can get consistent, decent, positive returns, actually that's pretty good for an investor. And, I don't think that the multi-PM platforms are necessarily a solution for everyone. But to the extent that you get some diversification embedded within it, I can see the appeal for some investors for having that approach. And in some ways, it's no different from having lots of very small and niche managers built together in a portfolio for you. It's done in a slightly different way, and it's aggregated in a different way. And maybe that's the solution you need in today's investing environment. Whether it's the optimum solution for everyone is a different question. But I think there are certainly some managers in that space that are worth looking at for some investors, given their governance requirements.
Just going back to inversions, if we can, it seems that behind every great inversion effort, there's a great hedge fund manager. People like John Paulson and Bill Ackman pushing for inversions in pharma. We've got the Burger King, Tim Hortons deal, obviously, with Buffett. But then there's 3G Capital right behind as a majority stakeholder pushing for the inversion. But I think, waiting for Obama's reaction this week, it's important to remember that, back in 2009, he facilitated an inversion from a struggling motor vehicle company called Delphi, which he okayed the spending of $1.7 billion of government funds to help relocate their headquarters to Gillingham in Kent, which saved them $110 million in tax each year. And I'm sure he'll be hoping that we've all forgotten about that, but we haven't.
Do you think hedge fund managers do that kind of thing? Perish the thought. Now, Richard, I know you wanted to pick up on that.
Tax. That was about tax. What is that exactly?
I think that's what people without teeth pay. On which note, I think let's get in another round of the delicious products of our corporate sponsors, Madoff Premium Ponzi Beer, and let's have some more music. Welcome back to the Naked Short Club. I am Dr. Stu, your host, and that was Mikey Cosmic's Sacred Geometry, Music to Nourish the Soul, with David Allen, Steve Hillage, Jean-Philippe Raquel, and Jilly Smith. You're, of course, tuned to not-for-profit Resonance FM, London's leading voice of radio art, the art, the particular, and the unexpected. Nearly 3 million listeners worldwide, and if you're one of them, or even one of us, support the station's continuing growth. Go to the Resonance website and make a donation. Now, guests, time's tight as a Spanish spread, so let's round things off, starting with you, Ian.
Dr. Stu, are you suggesting that the Celtic tiger is now toothless post the referendum? Just be careful with that phrase. It may be the one that proves to be the nail in President Hollande's coffin, les cent dents, according to the ex-squeeze, the fragrant Valerie in her Kiss and Tell. Remember, hell hath no fury like a Rottweiler scorned.
Very good, very good. Simon.
I was going to go briefly back to ESG investing, environmental, social and governance investing, because I got some very odd looks around the room when I mentioned it right at the start. And although I will do my best to try and convince you that there's merit in considering these issues when you're investing, that thinking about environment and social impacts on companies and the impacts on the stock price has value in what they do, even if I can't convince you of that in and of itself, I would just like to flag that there are lots of large, particularly large institutional investors out there that have ESG policies in place in their traditional assets. And for the meantime, they've put hedge funds in that too hard box, the part of the portfolio that is just too difficult to work out how they approach ESG factors. But at some point, that challenge will come back to them and they'll think about, well, what do we do? Do we want to stay in the hedge fund space without addressing these issues? Or will hedge funds, before that happened, have woken up to the opportunities and responded accordingly?
Dr. Stu, on the subject of inversions and on the subject of our kilted neighbours to the north, I think there's a common point here, which is that inversions are, of course, tax-driven. There's been some attempt to pretend that they're not, but everybody knows that the US corporate tax rate is the highest in the G7, in perhaps even a wider group of countries. And so these are driven entirely by tax considerations. You pretend to be taken over by a foreign company so that you don't pay tax on the worldwide revenue at American rates. And this just bears witness to the idea that if you keep the tax rate high, then you reduce the tax take. And so if governments need to be funded, as of course they do, then the best way to achieve that is to find some idealized, low-ish tax rate. And so on the subject of Scotland, because they are going to have full tax-raising powers, no doubt, within the next 2 or 3 years, then they will not be able to run the socialist paradise that they imagine with high taxes, which will drive people away, who will therefore no longer pay tax, in order to fund the lavish expenditure. Nobody has a problem with lavish government expenditure as long as it can be paid for in a free market. And that means low taxes and a very high tax take.
Going back to hedge funds and pensions briefly, Simon's made a great case for hedge funds, but what will the UK do and what will its pensions fund do? Just to make a point, London Pension Fund Authority and Edmund Truell has said he understands why CalPERS made the move that they did. Meanwhile, we've got the National Association for Pension Funds saying it's sticking with hedge funds. Who knows how it'll end up in the end? I'm off the fence, but I'm not telling you on which side.
CalPERS, maybe the sort of bellwether, maybe a fulcrum point in the market. We shall see. Take the point from them about complexity of products as well as the fee level. Inversions, well, who knows what may happen. No doubt we'll see some Scottish industrialist taking over an English batter manufacturer and Mars bar importer to get a lower tax rate.
So I'm glad I seem to have made some progress in convincing someone about hedge funds for all their faults, and I think there are faults galore, and there are areas that can always be improved. I do think they help make a better portfolio for investors, and so I think it's important that we keep allocating to them, but we would like to see them a little bit more improved in some of the areas we've been talking about today to really get the most of them for institutional investors.
Well, my banker tells me that there's nothing wrong with hedge funds. Thank you very much. Keep that 2 and 20 going, folks out there. Anyway, before we move on to calling the markets, let's hear again from Kate Brain.
Darling girl, I asked the nurse to post this to you after I'd gone. I sent this letter for you by way of that kind nurse, the one with the cheeky smile, you know, who sewed the label on your lacrosse shirt for me. Kind, sweet Molly, Nurse Molly. When you read this, I will be looking down at you, and I'm proud of how brave you've been, sweet pea. I know you're only young, but what a trooper you have been. I have made a list, don't groan, with some important things for you to carry out and to carry on for me. My will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Your papa must be hugged often. He must be strict at times with you and you with him. He needs to be reminded not to run out of his pills and no crackling or butter except Sundays. Any cuts, however small, Savlon's in the medicine drawer. Split plastic bags, dustbin and brush hanging on the nail by the door, and brush those gnashers up and down, or from up here you'll feel my disapproving frown. Last thing at night, do kneel for your prayers. Say them slow, I'll be there. Now summer's past, deadhead my roses. Do fill up the bird feed basket. Winter's coming, and the robins will be hungry. Christmas presents are ribboned in the attic, and carrots and a glass of whiskey. Oh, poor Father Christmas will be so busy. At school, if you were ever naughty, just remember, don't get caught. And finally take my place on the swing seat with your papa, like I loved to when the sun went down. Now, let me tell you how life is here. Good news for you. God doesn't care for the small things, but only that your heart is big. So don't be scared. So, hugs for papa, feed the birds, sherry for the milkman on the 25th, and most of all, love, 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 Mummy.
Wow, that was pretty good. Thanks. Since we're all here to make money, let's very quickly, starting with Richard, sup the last of your Madoff Premium Ponzi beer and stop throwing those delicious honeyed pecan nuts from the Naked Nut Company of California at those passing tourists. Use the bar nuts instead. Far too tasty to waste on common folk who pay taxes. Anyway, Richard, where would you put your money over the next 12 months and why?
Metropolitan real estate in Germany. I think this is for the third year running I've made this suggestion, because those things which push Germany upwards are still there. That means the euro.
I'm going for the macro hedge funds. Dr. Stu, the HFRI macro index was the strongest monthly gain last month since 2011. And also, obviously, the Naked Nut Company.
Okay. Yeah, they are the latest and certainly the tastiest of the corporate supporters of Resonance FM. Well done, you. And do contact Dr. Stu if you want to become another supporter of this very worthy project. Anyway, Simon, where would you put your money?
Oh, at some point, Tesco has got to become cheap enough to want to have an allocation too. But for the moment, I'm still in a small little portfolio of small cap companies that I think will have attractive opportunities for the next few years.
Okay, and Ian?
I think anything will become cheap enough eventually, even Tesco, but I'm not going there yet. Maybe I'll just short the euro.
Okay. Anyway, sounds like you rich and rather contemptible hedgies will just get richer and more contemptible. Now, listeners should not act on what they hear on the Naked Short Club. Invest only with regulated professional advice. Equally, don't assume that all wealth is odious. Dr. Stu's was inherited, which is, of course, okay. Or he won it at cards, which is laudable. Now, thanks to all of you great guests. gosh, I've been smoking too much alpha. Richard Edwards, Gabriella Griffith, Simon Fox, Ian Prideaux, also master engineer Chris Dixon. Check out his Resonance show, Cafe Calcio. Details on the Resonance website. And most of all, Kate Brain, brilliant poetry as always. Also, thanks to all the Emergency Hedge Fund Helpline callers and to Bernie and the Switchboard team. We've had lots of distress coming in, especially from the US this time. From Jersey, west of the Hudson, civilization, a volatile share price, then a very depressed VIX index from Chicago, a compressed-sounding TED spread from Manhattan and his frankly, absurdly tight-sounding sister, Greeks over Buns, weird name to give a child, from Minneapolis with lots of latency issues, albeit low, and Al Goh, no relation, I think, and his Swedish half-sister, Toxic. Just remember, folks, anyway, Dr. Stu is here to hear and help. Also, thanks to the City of Amsterdam for the free love and hotels, plus our longtime corporate sponsors, Made of Ponzi Beer, and again, to Resonance's latest and most tasty of all supporters, the Naked Nut Company. Crunch, yum, delicious, I believe they say. So, next week in Jerusalem, leaving you with the sound of Tangerine Dream, just remember, doing as you would be done by and loving kindness are all that really matter. The rest is just commentary.
You're tuned to Resonance 104.4 FM.